Good evening. It's with great pleasure that I welcome you here this evening. My name is Heather Merrill, and I'm the Executive Director of the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College and a professor of geography in the anthropology department. We have a great program for you tonight with several chapters of thought-provoking entertainment. We begin with a panel discussion, followed by the showing of The Situation, and ending with a presentation and audience question and answer period with the distinguished film director, Philip Haas. We are honored to have three eminent guests on our panel tonight that I would like to introduce to you. Major General Robert H. Scales, Jr. served as Commandant of the Army War College in Carlisle and is a military analyst for National Public Radio and Fox News Network. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, Lawrence B. Wilkerson, was Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff and served as Director of the U.S. Marine Corps at Quantico. Stephen C. Clemens, which is last year, is Executive Vice President of the New America Foundation and Director of the Japan Policy Foundation. My colleague, David Cummins, will join me in asking questions of these panelists. David Cummins, a professor of history specializing in the Middle East, has done extensive research on Syria and Saudi Arabia. My colleague, Doug Stewart, will moderate tonight's discussion. Douglas Stewart is the J. William Stewart and Helen D. Stewart Chair in International Studies, Business and Management, and a professor of political science and international studies. And I will now leave it to Doug Stewart to moderate the panel. Begin.
Thank you very much, Heather. As Heather mentioned, my colleagues, Professor Merrill and Professor Cummins, have each constructed some questions for our panel. The strategy here is to bring these three experts to Carlisle to prepare you for the film by some in-depth discussion about the U.S. policy process and the situation in Iraq, and they are well qualified to do so. Since we have time constraints, I will be a fairly strict disciplinarian. Professor Merrill will ask each of the panelists one question. They will have 8 minutes to respond. When they have finished, Professor Cummins will ask one question of the entire panel. Each member of the panel will have 5 minutes to respond to that question and to offer any summary comments they would like to make. Because of the time constraints, we're not going to be able to open the first part of our program to questions from the audience. However, the very good news is that the director, Philip Haas, after the film, has kindly agreed to discuss the film, and there will be four microphones distributed throughout the auditorium for folks in the audience that want to ask questions. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Professor Merrill to ask the first question.
Great. First question is for General Scales. General, in a recent interview, you suggested that the U.S. has a difficult time understanding foreign cultures. Philip Haas's film, The Situation, paints a portrait of a U.S. military in Iraq with little understanding of Iraqi cultures, failing even to speak the local languages, a U.S. military that has not built trusting relationships with local Iraqis. Without cultural understanding, do you think our military will be able to play a stabilizing role in the building of a new Iraqi nation?
Well, first of all, you guys are a heck of a lot more structured than Bill O'Reilly, so I feel very comfortable tonight. thank you for doing that. What you'll see in this film, I think, is a manifestation of a phenomenon that those of us who have been watching this war from a distance for a long time have seen over and over again, that my generation of soldiers have been raised in a technocentric view of warfare, that warfare is essentially an act of kinetic action, that the purpose in war is to strike targets, to establish networks and so forth. And what we've learned is that the enemy has a vote. And our enemies have learned that, in fact, that war is now being fought from a human and cultural perspective, and that wars will be won or lost not so much from our skill at arms, but from our ability, to your point exactly, to understand cultures, to be able to commune with people. Because at the end of the day, look, we're at Carlisle. This is the Army War College. If you don't mention Clausewitz at least once in a night, the audience is disappointed. But at the end of the day, Clausewitz is right, that war is essentially a test of will, that it's a human contest between two sides, both of whom fully expect to win. And the great sadness in this war, and what you'll see illustrated in this movie, is that soldiers of goodwill are separated from Iraqis of goodwill by a barrier of cultural ignorance. It works both ways. We have an army that is trained to kill but not to commune. We have soldiers who have empathy, but they don't have the ability to translate that empathy into action, because all too often they don't understand the culture, they can't speak the language, and they don't have the ability, as we've had in the past, to connect to an alien culture. And so if we believe what this administration is telling us is that we're engaged in a long war, what we're also engaged in, to my mind, is an imperative to change the way we approach conflict in the future, to move from a technocentric to a cultural-centric approach to warfare, where victory will be determined by our ability to influence will and to shape perceptions, where empathy becomes a weapon far more important than something like body armor or shoulder weapons, where at the end of the day, the ability of a region of the world to understand the goodness and the value of American values or Western values is far more important than simply gaining and holding territory. And the problem that we have, as you'll see in this film, is that this is not anything that can be learned overnight. That at the end of the day, this is a challenge for education. It's the ability to create a new generation of officers who are able to speak alien languages, who are able to connect to alien cultures, who understand the art of war, who understand that warfare and its challenges are essentially a human, cultural, cognitive, and behavioral challenge rather than merely the ability to put steel on target. And since my generation, I can see from the gray hair in the audience, the generation out in front of me for the most part, is raised in a different environment, it truly is a clash of cultures when we come to fighting the long war. But it's not so much our ability to understand alien cultures, but our ability to understand our own culture and our ability to select and to promote and to educate and to train and to groom a new generation of men and women who are able to do different things, like build alliances, to establish country teams, to bond with such alien cultures as the State Department and the Commerce Department, to be able to, instead of having a war of preemption by intervention, to have a war of cultural preemption, where we beat the enemy to the line of departure when it comes to helping to shape governments and to build armies and to establish coalitions. At the end of the day, the coin of the realm in this new era of warfare isn't weapons or isn't airplanes and tanks and ships. At the end of the day, the coin of the realm is trust. And the ability to build a mutual sense of trust between us and those nations that are willing to stand up to the threat of global terrorism. And you build trust one soldier at a time. You do it by building coalitions and partnerships. And in one sense, you do it by sublimating national ego in order to achieve long-term objectives. The American people will not necessarily be made safe by having a nation that's a global bully. Instead, the American people will be made safe by the United States being part of a global partnership. We may be first among equals, but we must be able to treat the world as equal partners if we're going to win this long-term contest against a diabolical and insidious enemy.
Okay. Thank you very much, General.
I'll go on to the second question and see if we have time for more discussion later on. Colonel, you have suggested that the military instrument is not sufficient to solve the conflict in Iraq, which, in the wider sense, is a conflict of ideas. As you have stated, you don't fight ideas with bombs, bullets, and bayonets. What, then, is the terrain and nature of this wider field of engagement? And how do you think the U.S. military can effectively engage or help to find political solutions to the conflict of ideas?
Thank you. I actually made that statement with regard to the so-called global war on terror, but it certainly has applicability to Iraq. And the reason I made it to the more comprehensive scene is because, essentially, I think what we're up against is not, as some in the so-called neocon world have coined it, Islamo-fascist. What we're up against is a radical element of Islam that doesn't represent the 1.3 billion Muslims who constitute the body of Islam. And so if you're going to fight this small radical group within this great body, the last thing you want to do is not adhere to one of the principles of good international relations, conservation of enemies. That is to say, you don't want to produce another 30, 40 million people who are willing to raise their right hand or whatever they do in Al-Qaeda and become members of the crowd. So the first thing you have to do is have better ideas than they do. And for one, I don't have a problem with our ideas. I think our ideas, as structured institutionally in the Constitution, as set down in precedent after precedent for some 200-plus years, are pretty damn good ideas. They're strong ideas. They're ideas that our founders were willing to die for. They're ideas that others throughout our history have been willing to die for. Indeed, they're ideas that I raised my right hand and swore to support and defend. Our ideas are better than their ideas. So the most potent weapon in this conflict is our ideas, not our bombs, bullets, and bayonets. And I find it quite striking that today, a nation that claims to be the world's leading democracy spends $500 billion on its military instrument and $30 billion on its diplomatic instrument. That is an imbalance that is incredibly disturbing and should be disturbing to every American citizen. That's not to say that the military instrument doesn't have a role within this wider conflict, not to say it doesn't have a role in Iraq. It does, but it should not have the dominant role. What should have the dominant role, as I said, are those ideas that made our nation great, and those ideas are carried by everything from our business people to our diplomats to our politicians and so forth. And the way you fight this wider conflict is you make sure that those ideas aren't corrupted, because the moment they're corrupted by Abu Ghraib, by Guantanamo Bay, by detainee abuse in general, by a vice president of the United States who publicly and openly advocates to the Congress of the United States torture, that's the way you destroy your ideas. That's the way you destroy your and my civil liberties. And, oh, by the way, at the same time, that's the way you destroy the base upon which you stand as you wage this conflict. You can't do that and expect to win. Boiling this down to Iraq, you look at the situation from the perspective of how many mistakes have we made not understanding what I just said. We have made at least a half dozen major, major errors in Iraq. Everything from disbanding the Iraqi military peremptorily to de-bathification and putting Ahmad Chalabi in charge of the de-bathification process. One of my first telephone calls in the State Department was from the president of one of the universities in Baghdad. Western-trained, secular, highly educated. He wanted to protest that he was a member of the Ba'ath Party simply because he had to be in order to be president of the university. He was not a Nazi. He was not a Baathist, and yet we removed him from the university. Multiply that across Iraq. Other bad decisions, not to stop the looting, not to send enough troops in the first place. You know them. They've been ad nauseum reiterated on news networks and so forth. How do you recoup from that position? How do you step back and say, okay, I understand that this is not necessarily a battle I'm going to win with the military instrument. It's a battle I'm going to win by providing jobs, by getting the economy going, by showing the 19.5-year-old Iraqi, which is the median age in Iraq, that he's got a better future if he works with me than if he works with the insurgents or even worse, with the terrorists. That's a real hard thing to do now that we've made so many mistakes. It is, in some people's minds, an impossible thing to do. But I return to my original point. If you're going to do this, you don't lead with the military instrument. If you're going to spread freedom and democracy, which is part of the goal of this, we now know, you don't do it with the military instrument. You do it by the very power of your values, your ideas, your political culture, your example. Most people in this world do not judge us by what we say. They judge us by what we do. And of late, what we do has been pretty damn bad.
Thank you very much, Colonel. Mr. Clemens, as a Washington insider, could you give us a sense of what the people in the Beltway now think of the U.S. plan to create a democracy in Iraq? What do you think Iraq will look like? What do they think Iraq will look like in another 3 years? Will the conflict spill over into Iran, for instance, Saudi Arabia, Syria?
Tough question. When you're here on a night when someone is going to provide a fictionalized account and has that opportunity to use a paintbrush to sort of tell the story, and sometimes stories get better than they really are. Sometimes they get worse. I think Philip Haas has the unenviable task of really telling things as they are in Iraq. And I have not seen the film yet, but I understand it's a pretty bleak depiction. And I think that's where fiction is taking us. But when you get into the reality of inside the Beltway today, I think that's a tough question to answer. If you look at any presidential administration, or you look even beyond the White House, you've got an exercise in schizophrenia that's pretty amazing. And you've got many different personalities, each trying to dominate in a complex array of choices. I think that's as true in the Bush administration as was in the Clinton administration or any presidential administration. And there are heroes inside this administration who were fighting against torture, were people like Larry Wilkerson and others working under the Bush administration who were not the dominant personalities that we were seeing. There were others that were dominating. And I think that as you get ring after ring after ring outside the Beltway, you get more personalities and more options. So is the question of how do we look at the chances of democracy in Iraq? I can't give you a fair answer to that. What I can tell you is how I look at it is that today we've opened a Pandora's box, and we've got some very tough choices. You know, there are people like myself who were writing at the time that Saddam Hussein was a lot like Tito in Yugoslavia or Suharto in Indonesia. And Suharto generally had, I'm paraphrasing Chalmers Johnson in this, but he once said that Suharto commented that anybody in Indonesia could have their own religion, but anyone who took it too seriously would be shot. And I think that, you know, there's something to that with what we saw in Saddam Hussein's Iraq. As horrible as that was and as much of a thug as he was, you nonetheless had a multi-ethnic capacity working together inside Iraq. Today, we're not fulfilling that same role. We believe that if we could bring civil society, institutions, ballot boxes, and some element of self-determination into that system, that it would quickly gravitate towards a fairly fair-minded system where everybody could find their way in, Shiite, Kurd, or Sunni. And that is not in fact working. So democracy as we see it and know it in the United States is probably not something that we're going to see for a long time anywhere in the Middle East, in my view. But there are important lessons out there that if we got off our high horse for a moment, we could take advantage of. I'm intrigued by Europe's success and basically penetrating, you know, growing its blob. I look at Europe as sort of a growing blob. And if you want to join Europe, if you're somewhere in the vicinity, as long as you're willing to choke down 80,000 regulations called the acquis communautaire, essentially, it's kind of like Star Trek and the Borg. The Borg go through and they either assimilate you or they annihilate you or they wall you off. Well, Europe essentially is an assimilation machine that has used carrots to essentially incentivize many other states who want to become, for security reasons, but also economic reasons, to become part of the European superstructure, and they've got to transform themselves, and they've got incentives to do that. There are no incentives today driving Iraq or any of the other major Muslim states in the region to become more democratized in a Western sense. We're not providing those incentives in a very square way. And there are lessons that we can learn out there to do that. So 3 years from now, I think you can either end up with an incredibly bleak picture, not only in Iraq, but in the entire Middle East. I won't say that Larry was optimistic. I think General Scales had some taint of optimism in his comments. But I believe America has shown quite unbelievably its limits in Iraq. And when you show your limits as a great state, your enemies move their agendas and your allies don't count on you as much. And the equilibrium that we had in the world, the equilibrium of interest that we had in the Middle East and globally, has been thrown out of kilter. And when you've got that, and you've got Japan, you've got Israel, you've got the European Union, you've got the Saudi Arabia, all behaving differently today than they would have 6 months ago, the world's in trouble because they're trying to fill a void that they perceive in our absence or because of our perceived weakness. And we have a president that doesn't want to be perceived as weak, and he's going to be driven in directions to make sure he can continue that, to show that strength. And sometimes that showing that strength can look like a pathetic act. And on top of that, you've got Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, you have Iran, of course, and I still don't think we've seen the end of North Korean misbehavior. You have people that perceive a lack of resolve in the United States, and that is a very, very dangerous time for the world. So to talk about democracy in Iraq when all of the other pieces in the world are moving is also, I think, a strained and challenged debate. That it's also a strange debate to have because we may be seeing the contours of global affairs changing very dramatically in many ways that are quite negative. I tell people that what I really worry about in the world is the United States transitioning from being a globally sprawling, globally engaged superpower, a hyperpower, a unipolar power, to becoming a normal great power. We will be an important and influential power for many years and decades and centuries to come. By our mere size, by the state of our economy, but that slippage from being a unipolar center of authority in the world, a rule maker and a benign player in global affairs, to something different, nonetheless changes the calculations of every other player in the rest of the world. And in that, I don't think our biggest concern is necessarily whether Iraq becomes a democracy. It's the question of whether America can continue to be at the edge of rulemaking and of generating stability and prosperity for a large portion of the world. And I think that's in doubt today. And I think we need to begin asking ourselves how this happened and what do we do to stem that hemorrhaging and possibly get us back into a position of slightly more influence and capability than we have today.
Thank you very much. Should we go on to... Well,
I guess one place to begin to answer your question, Steve, about how the world perceives the United States today, of course, is going to be how things evolve in Iraq and perhaps even conclude in Iraq. And I think the film offers a certain perspective on the situation in Iraq. In a conversation with a visiting Iraqi scholar here, however, I learned that there's another view of the situation, and I think how that falls is going to have a huge impact on how the rest of the world perceives the U.S. And so my question for the panel assumes that you've seen the film, but if you haven't seen the film, that you can imagine different reporters coming from the Sunni part of the country or the Shia South, all right? The plot centers on developments in the Sunni Triangle in one of its major towns, Samarra. My question is, would a film depicting developments in the Shi'i South, say in Basra or Najaf, have necessarily suggested different conclusions about the situation. And I'm thinking especially about the remark at one point in the film that the current situation is worse than it had been under Saddam.
Well, I think the situation is worse than it's been under Saddam day to day, simply because of the denial of basic services and because of the rate of loss, the tragic rate of loss of the Iraqis. So the question is, I guess your question is, so what happens next, and what do we make of that?
No, would somebody from the Shi'i South conclude that the situation is worse than it was under Saddam?
Oh, absolutely. I think they would. I don't think there's any question about that. I am concerned, though, that we don't put so much capital, if you will, on those points of intersection. I think again, Clausewitz calls these the decisive points, or the points of intersection, that we lose lock, or we lose track on what's happening in the rest of the country. I think what's at stake right now is, again, back to my thesis about this war being a test of will, that at the end of the day, the Iraqi people are going to look at what happens in the Sunni Triangle as a metaphor, if you will, for what's going to happen at the end of the day. I have a good friend of mine, a four-star general, who has been to this nation many, many times, and he said to me just last week, he says, there's only one thing that Jerry Bremer ever got right. And he says that was that the only thing that matters in Iraq today is security. Nothing else matters. Not electricity, not water, not garbage collection. The only thing that matters in Iraq today is security. And the canary in the mine for security is at that point of intersection between the Sunni and the Shia communities. And someone asked me the other day, well, what in the heck does the surge ever expect to do? Isn't Dave Petraeus been dealt a losing hand? And I guess if there's just a tint of optimism in what's happening today, it would be at this point of intersection. Because if the Iraqis, not us, if the Iraqis at the end of the day can achieve some form of stasis at these points of intersection, these nine wards, if you will, in Baghdad and the four outlying communities, and begin to stabilize the level of violence, and to create at least a promise of security, then the odds are perhaps even, maybe even better than even, that over the long term, as we begin to withdraw our forces in 2008, that the Iraqis can continue in this process of achieving and maintaining stability. But here's the problem. The problem, as I've seen most recently, is that we have too much strategy and too few troops. That we have more mission than we have boots on the ground. And my fear is that we're going to run out of capability before we run out of opportunity. And it's hard to express to you, particularly in an unclassified sense, what dire straits the military is in today in Iraq, and how few cards that Dave Petraeus has to play in this very critical period in our history. We have an army that is overwhelmingly unready for combat. We have soldiers that are spending 15 months in Iraq with a year between tours, or a year in Iraq with 9 months between tours. And whether the Democrats decide on a cutoff point or not, at the end of the day, they're not the ones who will decide the cutoff point. Sadly, the cutoff point will be decided by the inability of us to sustain this effort long enough to achieve what everybody wants in Iraq, and that's security. And the lesson for the future is, next time you go to war, the old ends, ways, and means balance, you better be darn sure that your ends, your appetite for ends, doesn't exceed the means or the troops that you have to fulfill those ends.
Take a shot at it.
Respond to that, yes.
Okay. I'm going to identify myself aggressively with the general's latter remarks. I think the Army and the Marine Corps are really in bad shape right now. I think they've been that way for some time. And I really find it unconscionable that some of the leaders of those services, even after Donald Rumsfeld was moved out of the Pentagon, still have only found their voices like sparrows. But the first part of his remarks I'm going to disagree with. The Iranians own the South. The British, realizing early on that they couldn't fight and really hold their own in Basra and the environment around Basra, said, okay, we'll make a deal. The Iranians had a plan for, Tommy Franks didn't. That's the joke on the streets in Basra. In other words, the Iranians had a post-invasion plan, we didn't. And so in the South, while there is some violence, it's not exceedingly bad like it is in the central portion of Iraq. And that's largely because the Iranians own the South of Iraq. Whether they will continue to own it or not is waits to be seen. In the North, the Kurds own the northern portion, and it's relatively quiet up there. They are certainly not Democrats. And our alliance with them is not much different than our alliance was with Uzbekistan, for example, or any other authoritarian government, because the Kurds do not run a democracy. But they're quiet. So the real problem in Iraq is in the center, and that's why you have people like Ambassador Peter Galbraith, with whom I testified to the Congress last week, and other people like Joe Biden, who say we should partition it. We should let the Kurds have Kurdistan, but don't call it that, please, because the Turks won't like it. We should let the Iranians and the Shia have the South, and if they have to fight a little, that's okay. It won't be too intense. And let's us concentrate on the center, but let's do it from Kurd territory. Let's move our forces up there. Let's let the civil war, the sectarian strife take place. However long it takes, we'll move in occasionally if it gets really bloody, but we'll let them settle it in the center. I hate to say it, but with the exception of the North, where I think the Turks would take a very grave exception to our doing this, that's probably the most palatable solution that I've heard for the situation in Iraq right now. And that's why I would say you would have a very different appreciation of this movie, or the point that you made about this movie, in the North, certainly, and I believe you also would have it in the South.
You want a third response? I'll just be very brief. I think one thing we've, you know, I'm a scenario guy, so I can find things in general scales and Colonel Wilkerson's comments to endorse and pick at. But I think the big thing that is tough to countenance is we removed Iran's chief regional rival without thinking about what that meant in the region. When you want to talk about Ahmadinejad and Iran's nuclear pretensions and what's responsible, we're responsible. We created it. Any junior-level strategist at the RAND Corporation or in military planning would have said, this is a natural result of knocking out Iran's chief rival in the region. Plan for it. Prepare for it. Iran will have greater pretensions in the region. And just like Malaysia wanting an automobile factory, automobile industry wanting to climb that ladder of being a great power, Iran wants to climb the ladder of being a great power where it is. And it's doing that through the vehicle of its nuclear ambitions. And that is problematic. I think that one of the things we also have to realize that unless you're willing to throw 500,000 people under arms with a staying capacity that we don't have. Zbigniew Brzezinski has made this point. Zbigniew Brzezinski is an advocate of withdrawal from Iraq, but he's saying there could be another way. There could have been another way, which is quintupling or tripling the number of troops we've deployed in the region and replacing Saddam Hussein with a kind of very ferocious and serious kind of force that would help quell not only a nation of 24 million people in Iraq, but also send a message to the rest of the region. We chose not to take that route. So one of the scenarios we need to think about is that the United States is less and less able to achieve outcomes in the region, less and less able to affect the welfare of the Shia South one way or the other. The Shia South are perhaps happy that Saddam Hussein is not terrorizing them or manipulating them in ways, but there are other parts of their lives that have probably been negatively impacted, as the general pointed out. But the bigger issue is that there are lots of nationalist Shias who resent Iran's encroachment and control as well. It's a very muddy picture. And what you see going on every day is the fragmentation of power. I actually think that we've achieved such a mess in the region that if you were to be honest and cutthroat and Machiavellian, as well as Clausewitzian, I suppose, Clausewitzian. I would think that we need to get back into the business of picking winners and losers on both the Shia side and the Sunni side and find which strong men and which side we'd like to support and arm them and help them consolidate power within Iraq. In their own bubbles of activity. Why? Because at the end of the day, if you're dealing with 30 warlords in Iraq, as opposed to four or five, and you can help them to stare into the abyss and see what life will look like, which will be pretty hellish if, in fact, they unleash a civil war at the levels that are possible there, that you can't do that with 20 or 30 people. And Maqdad al-Sadr, who used to be a strong man, clearly still is a strong man in Iraq, nonetheless is far less influential today than he was 9 months ago. And so we're seeing America look more and more like just any other militia. We're preempting the kind of deal-making that needs to go on both internally inside Iraq, and we're preempting the kind of deal-making that needs to go on with the stakeholders in the region, in my view. And in that circumstance, yeah, the Shia South may have more pleasant days than others. But overall, the frog is boiling in the pot dramatically, and we can't change the temperature, either up or down increasingly. So that's my concern.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Clemens. Do we have time for any responses to that?
Thanks, Steve. Yes, I think I'll give colleagues on either side of the podium the opportunity to offer any concluding comments. And then we'll move. I'll turn it over to Professor Merrill for the transition to the next part of our program.
Yes, Ashley Teasdale actually will come up, one of our students. She'll do that. Thank you.
Wrap-up comments by anyone? Anything you heard
General?
That offended, outraged, or confused you?
Never offended.
Never offended. All right. Well, then, Ashley, I'll turn it over to you.
Good evening. My name is Ashley Teasdale, and I am a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. Firstly, I would like to thank the panelists for their insightful responses to the questions posed. They were very informative and have certainly set an excellent background for the film we're about to see. This time, I would like to present the panelists with these plaques to thank them for their participation in our event. If you are expecting to see just another typical film, war film this evening, I think you'll be very surprised. The situation is not a stereotypical war movie. Yes, it is about a war. There is fighting, there is suspense, there's even romance. The situation delves much more deeply into the conflict than the average high-budget Hollywood film. Very few fictional feature films are created before the resolution of the conflicts they portray. Philip Haas boldly attempts to make sense of the United States occupation in Iraq without the benefit of the hindsight that filmmakers usually have to work with. Though it is written by a journalist, Wendell Stevenson, this independent film differs greatly from mainstream media reports. The situation penetrates the headlines and the statistics to show how Americans and Iraqis are being affected on a daily basis. It puts a real human face on the U.S. occupation with its multi-layered cast of characters who represent various sides of the conflict. Filmed on location in Morocco, the film gives audiences an honest glimpse of what it is like to be in Iraq. Soldiers and journalists who have been stationed in Iraq have attested to the film's accuracy. Instead of using sweeping shots of dramatic battle scenes, the filming is done entirely with handheld cameras to give the viewer the sensation that he is in the midst of the fighting. The situation is directed by Philip Haas, who is here this evening and will participate in a discussion about the film after this evening's viewing. Co-written by Haas and Stevenson, the script reflects what Stevenson saw and heard through her personal and professional experience.